Hello and welcome to this episode of Nothing Ventured with me, Arish Shah. Today, I am super excited to have with me Amardeep Palmer. Amardeep is the co-founder and host of the Bay HQ podcast, which inspires, connects, and guides British Asian entrepreneurs, as well as the host of the Entrepreneur's Handbook, where he has interviewed amazing guests like Ev Williams, the founder of Twitter and Medium. In today's episode, we talked about how to create content, where to get started, how Amardeep became one of the fastest growing writers on Medium, how brands should stand out today in this ever-changing world, and much, much more. You're not going to want to miss this episode. Hello and welcome to Nothing Ventured. Today I have with me Amardeep Palmer. If you want to learn more about Amardeep's background, please check out the primer, which was released a couple of days ago. You can get a full download about him and how he got to be doing what he is doing today, which is the co-founder of Bay HQ, a podcast that inspires, connects, and guides British Asian entrepreneurs, as well as the host of the Entrepreneur's Handbook, an amazing podcast where he has talked to massive personalities from the world of tech, venture, and business. Amardeep, great to have you here in the studio with me today.
It's great to be here on the other side of the table.
Yeah, absolutely. We're going to dive straight in. I think, you know, this podcast is typically about venture and the ecosystem in general, but a large part of that recently has been around the creation and the spreading of content. So what I'd love to understand from you, what does it take to create content today and really stand out these days? Because it feels like there's a lot of noise out there. There's a lot of people obviously trying to create their own personal brands and do various things. So what would your advice be? How can people get into the content game, or should they be doing it? Do they need to be doing it?
It's really interesting because there's so many different things that are happening at the moment, right? So obviously with AI and ChatGPT, and so many people are very bullish on it, and you probably saw all over your LinkedIn about, oh, now everybody can create content. But as you said, that's actually a bad thing in many ways, because that creates so much more noise now. So when you're reading things on LinkedIn, before somebody is, I say somebody, is often it's a ghostwriter, especially for the big founders, which I think maybe that's pulling the sheet away a bit there, is that if you're following somebody on LinkedIn and they're a massive founder, it's likely they're not doing their own content. It's somebody like me doing it. But what's happening now is there is an incredible amount of noise. And how do you stand out in that kind of aspect is always by personal stories. Because the advice is everywhere. If you say five ways to do this or five ways to do that, right? Cool, it might be useful, but it's just a blur. People don't actually act on it, right? Whereas if you can really tie that to your personality, tie it to a story, then people know how to act on it, right? And that's the entire, like, of humankind, right? How did you learn about morals? It's fables. It's all that kind of stuff. It wasn't just, oh, don't do this or don't do that. You had these stories to tell you that, because then it sticks with you more. And that principle doesn't change with AI, with anything else. And in terms of getting into the content game, it's always worth just starting and testing the waters first, because one of the biggest problems people have is just not starting. And what you'll realize when you start is nobody cares. And it sounds bad, but most people aren't going to read your content at the beginning,
right? There's a great book that I think it's called Nobody Gives a Shit About What You're Saying. It's like, exactly that.
And the worst thing that can happen, well, what people think is the worst thing that can happen is that nobody's going to read it. Whereas that's not the worst thing. The worst thing is you write something terrible and it's more toxic, or you're doing things in a bad way and lots of people see it. That's the worst thing. So as long as you're writing something that you believe in, what's the worst that can happen? Well, somebody can not read it. Cool, whatever. Like, that's it.
I think this, like, we were talking about this earlier, it raises this, right, really interesting point that I've thought about a lot. So I'm a massive fan of kind of fiction writing, and I've read a lot of Terry Pratchett. And one of the things Terry Pratchett talks about is that human beings are storytelling apes, right? So the things that actually get us going are the things that can generate some emotion in us, right? So as you say, like a listicle, yeah, okay, fine, it's information, but there's nothing that attracts you or pulls you back to that story. Whereas if you are telling a story about the things that have challenged you, or the things, you know, the things that you've learned, like, you know, I had a post go viral on LinkedIn, which was just like a list of 100 things that I'd learned, but it was very much tied to kind of how I think about things and my own personal experiences. And I think I agree with you. I think, you know, a lot of people make that mistake of just not putting pen to paper, as it were. In fact, I remember on Medium, as an example, we'll talk about Medium a little bit because you've obviously had quite a lot of experience with it. You know, there was a publication called 100 Naked Words, which was just a challenge to write 100 words a day. And, you know, it's surprising how when you are forced into that rhythm of just writing or creating content, whether that's, you know, doing a podcast, whether that's writing a blog, whether it's something else, just that consistency, it kind of builds up that muscle memory. And I think the most surprising thing for me has been, like, I was doing a lot of that on LinkedIn back, you know, 5-6 years ago. I found it really interesting that it wasn't like, you know, the one thing that people were engaging with. Over time, people just started engaging with the whole, my whole personality, because I was just being authentic on LinkedIn. And I think that's maybe, you know, one of the things that it sounds like, you know, you're saying is, if you're an authentic person, you're going to get much more love, if I can put it that way, than if you are just writing the same crap as everyone else, right? And I think to your point around ChatGPT, I actually posted something recently where I'd said, like, I'd written a couple of posts with ChatGPT, but they just didn't feel like they had any authenticity or personality behind them. And I think, you know, when writing lacks personality, it's not engaging, even if it's informative. And I think, you know, it's that engagement, it sounds like, is really important. So yeah, I mean, the other kind of question I also kind of had that somewhat ties in, so why BayHQ? Like, why is that an important story? Why are British Asian entrepreneurs, you know, a cohort that you wanted to highlight? And what are you actually trying to do with that podcast? Like, what is the objective, if I can put it that way? Or even, is there no objective, just to provide information?
So on the previous bit about, as well, you said about the engagement side. What a lot of people don't realize as well is that most people who read your content might find value from it, but they don't like it or they don't comment on it, right? And that's what people mistake, is that I've had people on my list for months or years who've never messaged me before, never liked anything, I've never seen their name before, but then they reach out and hire me. And that's what you've got to remember as well, is if you're just doing what you believe in and people are watching, even if you don't necessarily realize. And I think you've mentioned it before in terms of the podcast, right? You've had people come reach out to you.
Yeah.
You had no idea they were listening, but they're actually quite big deals. And then, so on the BayHQ side, if you think about a lot of my brand from like January 2020 until last summer, was mainly American-based, mainly Silicon Valley in New York. And what I was doing is essentially interviewing a bunch of very, very rich white guys, which is great. But what I was seeing is, okay, I'm helping people who are already successful in many ways. And then I was looking here, and one of the big things that used to frustrate me a lot is how within our community, it feels like there's so much of a status game all the time, right? It's who's doing better than who, rather than let's help each other and let's all do better. And me and a friend of mine were chatting about this and we were like complaining. And then we're like, why don't we do something about it? Like, there's no point complaining if we've got the power to do something about it. I've got the media experience. My co-founder's got a venture capital and LP background. So why not us, right? And what it looked at is just the idea of, we talk a lot about diversity, but I think so much of what's happening in diversity is also led by America. And the demographics are different in the UK. So what I say is 20% of London, according to the last census, is British Asian. And people don't necessarily realize that, or they're under index on that. So you might say, oh, we see British Asians in here, here, and here. Is it 20%? Is it 20% of people are getting funded is British Asian?
Hell no.
In London? No. And it's really interesting what we're looking at the stats recently. And we're seeing there are more people starting to get pre-seed or seed funding. But look at the later stages, there's a lot less Asians there. So what's that gap there? Why are some of the Asians getting the early stage funding, but they're not continuing on? Or is it just a case of it's a wave now? Those people getting pre-seed will hopefully then get Series A or B down the line. And it was quite exciting for me, because what's been happening is it's been so much led by curiosity up until this point. Of, oh, that's cool, I'll do that. It's always opportunities coming towards me. But with the BayHQ, because it's our brand, it can really lead it, right? So it's, okay, so I've got a podcast experience. Okay, I've got editor experience. Okay, my co-founder's got experience looking at pitch decks, the finance experience. So we can create an entire model. And the base of this is going to be an ecosystem. The podcast is just the lead magnet, phase one, right? Phase two is in progress. So we're starting to do written articles and written interviews. We're starting to do more on the venture side and help people out on that side. But the idea is all the other organizations exist. We're not competing with you. we're highlighting you, right? You're doing something great, we're showcasing you. And that's what we're trying to change, is the whole idea behind sometimes people are doing things that are good to show, look at us doing things that are good. But they don't promote other people doing similar things that are going to help their audience because they want to have all the glory. Whereas we're doing the opposite of that. Like, okay, you've got an event that you think is going to benefit our audience. We'll put it on a newsletter. That's fine. Like, we don't need to have any rivalry there, right? And it's even, for example, what I'm going to write the weekend is other British Asian podcasts you should be listening to. Because it's not about you need to listen to me. It's if there's other people doing great stuff, listen to them too. Find the voice that resonates with you. It's not all about me or us.
Yeah, I think I think that's a really, really interesting perspective. Obviously, I'm a British Asian, I'm an East African Asian. You know, family's been here, you know, all of my life. But one of the things that I've noticed as I've grown up, I'm in my mid-40s now, a lot of people that I grew up with, a lot of Indians I grew up with, and, you know, I'm very privileged, I went to a private school, you know, they've all become doctors, lawyers, accountants. But one of the things that is like a recurring story with them is, I'm bored, I wish I hadn't gone down this path, but I don't know how to break out of it now. And it feels like there isn't a way of doing that. And I always say to them, well, you know, I was 35 or 37 or 38 when I started my first business. Like, there's nothing to stop you doing that other than yourself, right? Like, it's about backing yourself. And I think the other thing that, like, usually resonates, I'm going to get a lot of flack for this because my mother is probably my one, like, actual follower who actually listens to every episode, bless her. But, you know, she has a habit, and I think it's a very sort of generational and cultural thing. You know, she perceives success by, you know, this person has, you know, just changed jobs or has got a pay rise or is now in this senior position in this sort of organization. And that's a very certainly Indian, but probably quite Asian way of looking at things. And actually, whilst, like, as a community, we probably love entrepreneurs. We all, like, in my community, we all talk about kind of dukawalas, like people who grew up in, you know, in shops, like ran shops. In fact, I was on a call recently when my aunts were saying, you know, it would be really good if our younger generation, you know, went and worked in a corner shop or in a retail shop, because it teaches them about XYZ. And I kind of said, yeah, it's great, but there are other things beyond just working in a shop, you know, other ways of gaining that experience. But I think we see entrepreneurship as probably being the lowest rung of the ladder in order to move towards stability, rather than entrepreneurship is actually an amazing thing that allows you to employ people, grow, contribute to society, etc. And, you know, I think that's really valuable. And I think the other point, and I'd love you to kind of expand on this a bit, is that whole concept of giving back, right? So again, a lot of Asians are very charitable, but potentially to causes outside of their community, or potentially, you know, nothing to do with business. But we tend to kind of hoard our stories and our success. Like, I don't want to tell you how I got here, because you might then try and basically steal my thunder. In fact, you know, you invited me very kindly to appear on the Bay HQ, and I reciprocated, because exactly for that reason, I thought, you know, the stories that we each of us have to tell are important, and more people should hear about them. So how are you able to kind of convince, given that that is sort of almost the sort of status quo is like, I don't want to share. How are you able to convince these people to get on and tell their stories?
I think a lot of it comes from this whole idea of this whole daisy cutting thing, right? The tallest daisy is the one that gets cut down. And sometimes people don't want to stick their head out because they think they're then going to, they're arrogant. Oh, look how big they think themselves, right? And it's in terms of the whole framing of what we're doing, it's, I don't want you to come on to talk about how great you are. And I think we've talked this before I recorded. It's like, I don't want you to boast. I want you to talk about the struggles you had and then how you overcame them. Because the key thing is, it doesn't matter how successful you are, you're always going to have those lower moments. And that's where you can really help people. And it's just in terms of how I talk to people, right? It's from talking to the people I have, nobody really intimidates me anymore. Like, if the founder of Netflix and the founder of Twitter, if they can be nice people, then if you've got an ego, then that's fine. You can go and do your own thing. I'm not going to beg you to come on. And that's just the framing, right? It's because people see that I'm doing it for the right reasons. And part of that is because I'm doing it for my dad as well, right? So people see that. And it's this whole thing I say, it's like, if I ever start to become transactional or trying to cheat people or trying to make it all about me, this all crumbles. And I actually really like that because it's a whole aligned with me, right? This only works if I am who I say I am. As soon as I'm not that, it all crumbles and I fail. Or fail of it, this organization no longer does what it's meant to do.
I think a lot of that comes back to incentives, right? So a lot of thought in my head has been about, you know, when does one take on sponsorship and things like that? And I don't want to necessarily go into the details of that. But the minute you start monetizing what you're doing in some way, shape or form, I think people then also kind of their radar pricks up and they're like, okay, well, you're doing this because it is providing some sort of benefit to you. And of course, there is a benefit to both of us in appearing on our respective podcasts. But the benefit is actually much broader, much more subtle than an exchange of money, a transactional exchange. And I think actually, you know, when we were talking about content earlier, one of the things that I think is probably most important when you're starting to do any sort of content is to not actually worry about how am I going to monetize it? Where's the money going to come from? Like, what, you know, one of the best podcasters out there, Dan Murray Setter, I think, you know, I can't remember the exact numbers, but you know, he just sunk money into his podcast, you know, Secret Leaders, for a long time. And I think now it's actually, you know, garnering him some money, but that was never the sort of objective. It was about creating amazing content that people want to listen to. And again, it came back to, like, when you said there about, you know, telling their stories and how they failed and how they overcame those, it comes back to that whole concept of narrative and what people engage with, which is humanity, right? It's like, we want to understand about people, what drives them and what motivates them, not just the kind of, you know, tick list of this is what I've actually achieved. But you know, going a bit further into this whole concept of, you know, creating content and driving that content. So you were, you know, you were one of the fastest growing writers on Medium via the Entrepreneur's Handbook, I think. So talk me through that. Like, was it something that was, you know, strategic? Like, you said you just started writing. At some point, did you decide, okay, actually, I'm going to do this in a specific way to build that audience, etc.? Or were you just like in the right time at the right, you know, at the right time in the right place? Talk me through how you built to that 50K and thereafter, like, what happened?
Sure. So on the content side as well, what I think is really important people to acknowledge as well is there's so many people online right now telling about how to make money from content, and that's monetizing for YouTube or for Medium, which is actually a really bad idea. I genuinely advise most people. What it's good for, same thing with this podcast, is people now know about your business. That's the better play. And that's what business should be thinking about. They shouldn't be thinking, how can I break even by making money for YouTube? Don't think about it as a revenue source directly. Think about how the brand awareness and what that can lead to. And that's what people should be thinking about. Medium, for example, is don't stake your life on making money from the Medium Partner Program. Like, I was making that amount of money, but I would never promise anybody else they can make that amount of money too. And that's what a lot of people do, which is quite scammy in my eyes.
For the audience's audience's information, I make 27 pence a quarter for the Medium Partnership Program. Yeah.
Yeah. So
100%.
Before I was quitting my job, I was making close to 10K per month from it, right?
Amazing.
Which put me in the top 0.001% or whatever. But for me to then tell you, oh, I can teach you how to do that, that's just bull, right? Because one, there's luck involved, there's my personality involved, it's all these different factors. I can never promise that. And in terms of my own journey, it started off as just completely for fun. But then once you start getting good at something, it then became a challenge. And what I actually found is my first article went viral. So that earned me, I think it's now close to $3,000, right? And then I had a fallow period where things I was writing, they were doing well, some of them got a few hundred dollars, but I didn't have that same success as that first article. And then it was that challenge now because, okay, I had that lucky break at the beginning.
Was it a one-hit wonder? Was it something I can replicate? Yeah, I completely get that, yeah.
And that's when I really started and actually became a better writer. But I don't know, for example, if I would have done that work if I didn't have that initial success. And that's why I always say there is a big factor of luck involved because people really enjoyed that article and just the way I speak and the way I talk about things. But I didn't know what I was doing. People asked me in the article, oh, how did you find a writer's voice? Like, I have no idea. I just wrote this and people liked it. And now I can tell you, okay, this is how you make it better and this is how you phrase things and this is how you can do things like that. But that came later on. And once I started really diving into what makes things good, how do I engage people, that's when I hit that really big purple patch, which was from, I think it was say May 2020 to until I quit my job, I guess. Because once I quit my job, you think I had more time for writing, but then I had so many other opportunities, I actually wrote less than when I had a job, which is weird. But what really helped in that is that I only wrote one half articles or two articles a week on average, which is actually different to most other people. Most people in my level were doing an article a day.
At a minimum, yeah.
Yeah. And what was happening is that the quality level of the average article was so weak that, or not, it was the same thing over and over again. Was when I posted, I put thought into it. There was a higher quality in there, which made people, when they followed me, when they click on me, they know I should have to put a bit of work into this. Whereas if you follow somebody else and you see the same article about five times with slightly different titles, you stop clicking on them. And that's one of the big things that I did well. But one of the things that happens is that pressure builds. As you start to grow like that level, it's different at the beginning. I didn't think anybody was going to care. Whereas now, all of a sudden, I have to live up to a, I put this mark on myself, right? Even people interviewing me like, oh, how did you write? How did you do this? I was telling people how to write myself. And when you start telling people, especially as an editor as well, I was ripping apart other people's articles, which is quite fun, to be honest. And like, okay, this is why your introduction is crap, and this is why it doesn't work, and this is how you should phrase it. These are all the problems with your articles. But then what was starting to happen to me, the imposter syndrome started coming later on, because now I had to live up to my own high standards. And what I'd advise people there is what I did isn't replicable. And in terms of the timing-wise, it was actually the hardest time to become a writer on Medium, because it was the pandemic. So the competition went through the roof. And a lot of the people who've been on Medium before and earning a lot of money, they were complaining all the time, like, oh, nobody can earn money in Medium anymore. And I was this massive outlier anomaly, right? And with the fastest growing side, the little stat I like to say is the only person who grew faster than me in the pandemic was Barack Obama.
Yeah.
Out of about 100,000 people. So me and him don't have that much in common.
Maybe.
Yeah.
Maybe not. Yeah.
But what it was is just, it took me 27 years or 20, I can't remember how old I am now, 28 years to become an overnight success, because I had this vast array of stories where when people read my articles, it wasn't going to be the same thing. It's the way I phrased things and the way I thought about things was the same, but I can draw on stories from karate background, from travel background, from dance background, from yoga, from all these different things I'd done in my life, where it kept it fresh, where some people use the same stories over and over again, which you might see on LinkedIn, for example, and a lot of people will say about templates in LinkedIn, you can grow very fast. But then very quickly, you start to realize, oh, they're just posting the same things.
Well, I mean, today you can disengage. You can go on LinkedIn by putting like a PDF carousel on, and it's just like crazy. It's just regurgitated content time and time again. I'd be interested to understand, like, so you clearly didn't have a framework and stuff. You knew what worked and what didn't, but you didn't necessarily follow a straight framework. But you know, you talked about your ideas coming from your previous life, but this was presumably for the Entrepreneur's Handbook, so it was all around entrepreneurship, is that correct? Or what, where did you get inspiration for the actual story? So you may have had an experience that lent itself to a certain type of story, but how did you think about what content to write? Like, what was the right article that fit your brand and your narrative and your personality? Because like, certainly as someone that has dabbled in creating content for a while now, you know, I think I was one of the fastest growing poetry writers on Medium. I don't want to brag, you know, but as I say, 27 pence a quarter, that's how much that gets me. No, but I mean, you know, for me, it's very easy to write poetry because that's just, you know, that's inspiration, just what's in my head. But when you're writing business articles or anything around entrepreneurship, you have to, you know, you have to have a certain, both a level of kind of experience, but also the topic has to be in demand, if I can put it that way, right? People want to know about how do I raise money, or what's the right term sheet look like, or, you know, how do I set up a company and get it started, or whatever it is. How did you choose those topics? Like, I'm really intrigued, you know, because every week it must be really hard to kind of come up with that fresh title and content, especially if you are, you know, unlike others, not regurgitating the same content and just, you know, chopping and changing and mixing it up in different ways.
So I think I became editor of Entrepreneur's Handbook in June, or I think it was July 2021. So it's after I had my next couple of hits, which I proved myself I wasn't a one-hit wonder. So up until that point, a lot of my content is really based more around, say, high achievers or ambitious people, which can be entrepreneurs, but it also can be other people. It's as I was the editor of Entrepreneur's Handbook, that's when my content started shifting more and more towards business.
Got it.
And that started happening later on. But in terms of the ideas, why I started writing in the first place, or where the whole New Year's resolution came from, is I was reading a lot of books at that point and also reading a lot of articles. And the more you read, the more I was disagreeing with, right? So it's like, you read a book and like, oh, that's it. Just the way they've said that, it doesn't sit right with me. And what I did a lot is before as well, say, I think the 6 months before I started publishing my first articles, I was commenting on other people's articles. And it's very lame to, I guess, admit that. But that's what I used to do, because I used to read someone's article and they'd say things a certain way and I really disagree with it. So one simple example is where people always say about being the smart, that you should be never be the smartest person in the room.
Yeah, it's one of my favorite ones.
Yeah, which yeah. I disagree with.
Excellent.
Because what
Let's
I say
have
is,
that out right yeah, now.
Because you should, sometimes you should be the smartest person in the sure. room. You should be helping people. So why would I want to be friends with somebody who never wants to be the person who's smarter than everybody else and helping them out? You should be in a mix of rooms, right?
Well, also, like, realistically, if you think about it logically, someone has to be the smartest person in the room, right?
Yeah.
So it's impossible not to have, you know, someone filling that role.
Yeah, and it's even with, I think sometimes people boast about being the dumbest of their friends. So then what that's telling me is that, oh, okay, so anybody who's dumber than you, you're now not being friends with. But then you want to be friends with me who you think is smarter than you. So then what, it's the whole logic I see is like, okay, so you only want to be friends with people you can get some out of.
Yeah.
And that's something I try to shift around and say, okay, actually, sometimes it should just be everybody's got different skills, right? Mm. And sometimes you can just talk to people because it's fun to talk to them.
I think also, though, and this obviously we see a lot of this on Twitter and on LinkedIn for that matter, it's that binary thinking that a lot of people have, right? It's either this or that, right?
Yeah.
So Apple good, Android bad. As it was, yeah. right, back in the day. Or now it's like Elon is awful for Twitter. Elon is amazing for Twitter. Well, maybe Elon's had like success and failure with Twitter since he took it over. Like the jury's still out because it hasn't been long enough, right?
Yeah.
And I agree, like a lot of what is actually valuable out there in the world is where people can have reasonable disagreements and debates and argue both sides or one side that is contrary to what other people think and move away from that kind of soundbiteism, which is just so pervasive in today's world, right?
Yeah, and that's how I think a lot of people are optimizing for attention
rather
than trust.
Yeah.
And what's actually more valuable? So let's say you get a ton of impressions and you get a ton of hate comments. That probably does have a bunch of revenue for you, right? If people actually trust you or actually like you, and this is what I always say to the podcast guests, you're not optimizing for impressing people or a number of views. It's the people that do listen. Do they then really like you?
Mm.
Do they then tell their friends, like, oh, I listened to this person who's got his business about this. They seem like a really good person. You should go with them. Because that's where the recommendation comes in, and it's really soft and it's not measurable, but that's the real difference. And that's what I was optimizing for, right? Is if somebody reads my articles, do they then think like, okay, I like this guy's opinions and the way he thinks about things. I want to read more. And what a lot of people do in, say, Medium is, you know, the whole painkiller vitamin thing, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Everybody is talking about, like, for example, you should quit your job because you're a slave. And just, and as the editor of an entrepreneur's publication, I got so many articles like that. And it's just like, what you're trying to do here is play on people's insecurities, make them feel bad about themselves. And is that the life you want to live?
And also, that's one of those topics which I find really interesting. I think everyone should understand what it means to go out and earn for yourself, right? Like in the sense that, you know, from a tax perspective, what are the improvements that you can get in your salary and so on. But equally, what are the challenges, right? Like, and also some people enjoy being an employee as part of something bigger. Some people, you know, want to do the 9-to-5 so they can spend time with their family or do other things that they love on the side. I think that whole hustle culture mentality is the other thing that's really kind of toxified a lot of the last 10 years whilst we've been riding this massive bull market. And, it actually hasn't helped the whole narrative around entrepreneurism, because it feels like, well, if you're not a 20-year-old, you know, willing to sacrifice your life to your business, then you're going to be a failure. And interesting, like I wrote, you know, I'm very clear that you are not your business, right? If the minute your ego gets tied up in your business, you are then bound to its success and its failures. And that can be a massively traumatic thing from a mental health perspective. But actually what you have to do is understand where the balance sits in your life, right? To be able to navigate both sides of that coin.
One thing I think that helped me as well is that I was anti-hustle culture in many ways, but at the same time in a black belt in karate, I've done all these different things. So to hear that argument for somebody who's actually achieved a lot of stuff, I think was really useful on my side, because I wasn't somebody who was just kumbaya, like, oh, you don't have to be successful. It's like, no, yeah, you can do this, but you've also got to realize the drawbacks. So it meant that I could talk to people at the same level, where sometimes there's the extremes, right? Like, okay, hustle culture is successful. And then people are anti-hustle culture, and then they just sit on the beach and do nothing, right? Yeah. But then because I blurred those lines and I could talk to different people, that was a big factor. And I think people listening right now, if you want to do content, that's what you've got to think about as well, is what lines do you blur, which is unusual, right? And how do you do that? So now, for example, what my initial brand was built on is a lot more common, right? Because one, say, for example, Medium, people saw me doing well, they then mimic it, right? And it's a very common thing, which is absolutely fine, because that's a good thing, right? If more people are thinking in a way that I think is healthy, then that's mission achieved, right?
Yeah.
And things are shifting now, which is really good. And people are talking a lot about mental health and things in a better way. So it comes back to the Bay HQ, right? That's the idea. If I got annoyed at people sharing a similar message to me that I thought was a good message, then what does that say about me? I just write my message because I want the attention. I want people to be sharing the same message to me because it's good for the world.
Yeah, I think that whole thing about blurring the lines is really interesting. And again, it comes back to that kind of, you know, binary way of thinking, the black and white way of thinking is either this or that way. Like, it's similar to sort of, you know, people who have issues with, you know, lifestyle businesses and lifestyle businesses doing 20, 30, 40, 50 million dollars or pounds in revenue or whatever. Like, those are still life-changing businesses. They're not lifestyle businesses. Venture capital, as an example, is one route that people can consider, but it isn't necessarily the only route. And I think, again, the more we can kind of break down the barriers of that binary thinking, the better. But look, I wanted to talk a little bit also, you know, you're a tech consultant, you still are, I think, to some extent, but you are working with massive brands. So we talked about like how an individual might want to think about creating content. Tell me how companies should be thinking about positioning themselves right now, especially given how tough times are, right? And we're seeing a couple of things happening. You know, you're getting obviously a lot of press around companies either laying off a lot of staff, often in really, really kind of dodgy ways, I would say. You're also getting a lot of companies I'm seeing at the moment pushing out a huge amount of PR, which immediately kind of makes me think, well, okay, maybe they're not actually doing as well as they're purporting to, because I kind of see PR as this sort of almost Hail Mary attempt to get a bit more attention and drive people towards you rather than necessarily being earned. And yeah, actually this company is doing really well and it's going on an upward trajectory. So I'd love to get your kind of impression on how brands should be thinking about, you know, their content strategies and their brand positioning today. Any other thoughts you have on kind of that sort of side of things?
I think one of the interesting challenges for like so many brands is the personal brand versus the business brand. And the thing is, we all connect with humans more, right? But if you're Nike, everybody knows Nike is different. And one of the challenges I think for many brands is understanding where they are on that scale. So if you're a founder of your company and you're very heavily involved in the business, people want to hear your story and why you care about it, right?
Yeah.
But a lot of people aren't comfortable with that. And they'll say, oh, but you don't know the founder of this company or that company. It's like, yes, but you're not that company. And it's kind of leaning into that. If, for example, you don't want to be the face of your brand, you still want to have people that are regular on your brand. So one example I look at is, say, Mob Kitchen. They've got over 1 million followers on Instagram. They have 6 different chefs that work for them, right? So they've got their overall brand, but that 6 different chefs, they are a face to it, right? It's people that you know. And it's always better hearing from the founder, because the founder can talk about a story they care about. Even, for example, the Entrepreneur's Handbook podcast, I'd always interview the founders rather than the CEOs, because CEOs that come later on, they're doing it as a job. It's not the same things that this is why I did it, this is why I started this company, it's the passion behind it.
What's the vision? What was the purpose that set me on this path? Yeah.
And with a lot of brands, especially the early days, it's really getting out your story, because then people can connect with that. But it also depends on who you're trying to attract. And a lot of people are listening to advice from the wrong kinds of brands. So if you're targeting B2B people, then there's no point in you trying to push out content to customers when they're not your target audience, right? And that's the interesting thing, is making sure there's some strategy in that way. But then it's also being authentic, because people can sniff out if you're just doing it for the views or for the likes. And like I said, like, most founders aren't creating their own content. I've written for over 100 founders, I think, easily in the last 2 years.
Spoiler alert.
Yeah. So, and I can't say who, it's one of the funny things about ghostwriting well, is you're not allowed to say who you've written for.
Yeah.
But I can say, so one of the companies is worth over 100 billion.
Right.
There's another probably 20 that are worth over a billion. So it's a big household name companies. But what they'll often do, the founder will leave me a voice note, and then I then write the content based on that voice note. Or they'll do a talk, and then I then write an article based on that talk that they gave. So it's still got to be some root in what they actually believe. And then I'm filling in the gaps and making it more engaging. And that's one way of doing it, right? Some people don't have the time. And if you're a founder, you don't have the time, that's fine. But then you've also got to give up some control. And that's a really difficult thing for founders. Because if something's coming out under your name, you've got to find the right ghostwriter. And this is where people say, like, oh, but you can just get somebody from Upwork for $5. Like, you get what you pay for.
Yeah.
And that's the interesting thing as well, is how do you, one, find the right person to ghostwrite for you if you want to go down that route? Or if you do want to write yourself, what cadence is right for you?
Mm.
Because like I said, you don't have to write every single day. If I'm trying to think of a good example, but there's some people who write once every 3 months, but when they write, that gains traction. So one of the people on Entrepreneur's Handbook, his company is called BitMEX. Mm-hmm. He writes twice a month. Each of those articles goes viral every time, because it's a big deep dive into what he's thinking. And that's it. You've got to find a cadence that's right for you and makes sense. And you've also got to remember to shed your ego, because most people aren't tracking how often you're writing. Most people don't realize if you miss a newsletter or if you do this or that. Like, give yourself some space there.
Yeah, I mean, I think I've mentioned on the podcast before, but Paddy McCormack, Not Boring, I think he only writes like once a month or
yeah.
You know, but they are like long, thoughtful essays about whatever topic it is. And obviously, for the most part, it's Web3 with him. And there are others, you know, of a similar vein. In fact, I read something recently that Dominic Cummings charges his readers to his newsletter $10, you know, a month, and he hasn't released anything for 9 months or something. So it's a good gig if you can get it, for sure. But yeah, I mean, look, I think, you know, that issue around founders, I think initially with the business, yes, it's the founder's voice, it's the founder's perspective. And, you know, if you're a founder that thinks that they can't write or can't speak or whatever, I think it's one of the skills that you have to learn, right? As a founder, mm-hmm. if you're going to be able to pitch for investment or pitch customers or pitch your own team, right? Like people you want to bring on board, you have to get comfortable with writing, with speaking, with communicating, mm-hmm. right? And I think, again, comes back to that whole point around narrative and being able to tell your story. Obviously, yeah, there is an inflection point where you maybe don't have enough time. But I think, you know, I not to bag on the fact that you're a ghostwriter, but I kind of see that as a bit of a cop out, yeah. Like, because
but it's also, most guys ghostwriters are terrible, right?
Yeah, I would imagine. Yeah. obviously, present company excluded, yeah. I'm sure. But yeah, I mean, you know, because again, it you can sniff out the lack of authenticity, I think, with a lot of them. And there's been I think there's also been a spate within the venture world of, you know, when a lot of VCs realized that they needed to be putting out TikToks and, you know, doing Instagram reels and all this sort of jazz, there was this kind of drive to find, you know, people who were good at content. Mm-hmm. To potentially also ghostwrite for the partners, because, you know, they weren't up for doing it themselves, which, you know, is sad, because I think you want to hear those stories direct from the horse's mouth, because it doesn't actually, you know, I've read some really poorly written articles, but with very good content inherently sitting mm-hmm. underneath them. And, you know, all it requires is a bit of a spit and a polish, right? Mm-hmm. Like, so I was doing some editing for a guy, you know, who's writing a newsletter called Angel Notes, who's doing deep dives into businesses that were crowdfunding on Republic and platforms like that, so Cedars and Crowdcube equivalents here in the UK. But he was of Italian origin, so, you know, his English was very good, but there was some stuff that, you know, the colloquialisms were slightly off, or the grammar was slightly off, or whatever it was. And I would edit it, like, and I would make, yeah. 5% maybe changes to it. The core of what he was writing was just so solid, but it was just getting it, you know, in a shape that actually, for a native English speaker, it flowed correctly, right? Mm-hmm. And I think more people should take up that challenge of writing, you know, mm-hmm. writing their content or doing their own thing.
There's also the PR side, right? So
yeah,
there's one side is the founder's voice. So that's coming from the company, or if it's a company. Also, generally, a lot of people I've experienced, well, they want to write it under the company name. You can't relate to a company. You can relate to a person.
Yeah.
You can say I, whereas if you say we, who is we? I'm not a we. Are you? Like, do you get what I mean? And you can't be multiple people, but you can relate to the individual because you can talk about your emotions. Mm. Where sometimes people say, oh, the team was this or the team was that. You can't talk about their emotions. You can't speak for them. You can only speak for how you felt.
Yeah.
And then on the PR side, that's what other people are writing about you. And this is a murky world because I've written in Forbes, I've written in Wall Street Journal, I've written everywhere, right? But you won't notice me because even a lot of those reporters, they have ghostwriters.
Yeah.
And this is the funny thing, is that lots of different like layers of, it's like PR inceptional kind of thing, right? Of somebody gets into Wall Street Journal, then they then hire that out to other people. They pay, you pay that reporter to get featured there, then they pay you a sum of that.
In the Philippines is writing. Or doing the research or whatever.
You look at the average article in some of these big outlets, they're not high quality.
No, because that's all about eyeballs and just churning out the content, right?
And there's so many of these lists, for example, Yahoo top 10 people in finance. How do you get on their list? You pay them to get on that list. And it's people, for example, people coming on the podcast, and you probably get the same thing. So we'll reach out and say, hi, blah, 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 blah. Like, I've been in this, I've been in that, I've been in this. It's like, yeah, but I know you paid for that. Mm. It doesn't make a difference. I've been featured in Forbes. Like, yeah, cool. If I pay $500, I get featured in Forbes too. And Forbes, it's not Forbes' fault, right? But it's just, when you've
they
got that many contributors.
Yeah, they found figured out a way of monetizing people's need for attention, right?
Yeah, and that's the interesting thing about PR is that a lot of people don't know what I know. Mm. So you get onto these different lists, it'll impress the average person. And that's why people sometimes get frustrated at me. It's like, oh, but I've been featured in this. Like, yeah, but I know how that works. I know how it just depends on your connections. So when you're looking at that PR aspect, it's, one, how friendly is that PR? Because often it is just friendly PR. And it's where the person writing it really matters as well. Mm. Because there are different people, say TechCrunch and these places where it's really in depth and you can tell that somebody's done a lot of research to get the article together. And that matters more. Whereas there are pieces which are kind of just paid for promotion. They're an ad, but you don't really know they're an ad. And those are still useful because you can put it on your website. And like I said, most people don't know the difference. But you've got to actually do the work too. Just getting PR doesn't necessarily mean anything.
It's that whole thing about earned versus paid, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
But if you've got Forbes on your website and you've got Business Insider on your website, that doesn't make you successful. And I think it's this whole thing of sometimes people think that's the end goal.
Well, interestingly, like on a lot of decks, and it's one of the biggest pieces of advice that I give to founders, like any of that stuff, unless it's earned, just remove it from your deck because that is not a signal of success. It's a signal that exactly as you say, you know someone or have been able to pay someone for the most part to write an article about you, right? So it's not that interesting.
It's if you have a Netflix documentary made about you, cool. Yeah. That impresses me, right? If you've been on BBC or been on this, it's like that just can be connections. Mm. If somebody's taken the time and put a budget behind getting you onto their show and they made a documentary about what you've done or something like that, that really impresses me and that's cool. And it's different because of I haven't done some of that stuff myself. And this way it always comes across a bit funny. Mm. But when I'm over 170 episodes in now, right? I've heard every story. I've seen every, I know how these things work. And I think sometimes people are chasing the PR too hard.
Yeah.
When it's actually sometimes you just get a good product and get customers on board that way as well. And if you've got a good product, people will then be word of mouth as well. And that can really help you. As if you've got all the PR in the world, but your product isn't good, it doesn't matter.
Doesn't matter, yeah.
And yeah, a lot of people forget that. So I'd always say, before you do the PR push, and I know people, they hold back doing their announcements to their funding rounds on purpose. Mm. And it's a good thing to do because you hold it back until your product is ready for people to buy and there's no bugs. Because then when you do that PR push, you probably will get some new users, but they're going to buy something that works.
Yeah.
And there's no point getting all this PR on a product that doesn't work.
Yeah. Although, I mean, like I always struggle. Like I've seen PR coming out about businesses like 3 months before they fold or it's 2 years after the actual fundraise happened, which, I get your point, but it's that it like it still feels like a bit of an odd thing to do. So listen, the podcast is called Nothing Ventured. The reason behind that is because, you know, I think people should always sort of take a, you know, take a leap of faith on themselves. So for those getting into the content game, other than just get started, what would be your like one piece of advice to people trying to get into, you know, either writing content, building content, or, you know, getting into that whole sort of world? Oh,
one piece of advice. So I think a big one is not to take themselves too seriously and be able to just learn and write how you talk as well. Mm. And well, unless you talk like a robot, then write more fun. But a lot of people that try to do is try to be impressive with big words and make it really complicated sentences. And that's one of the big things I always did when I was editing is just be like, nobody wants to read this. This is boring.
Use the Hemingway app, yeah. Strip it down.
Yep, Hemingway app. I always recommend that. Yeah. It's the Hemingway app, people who don't know what it does is it highlights the line. So I think it's red if it's a very hard to read sentence, yellow if it's hard. And you want that right mix. And you want a grade level basically between, say, 5 and 8 is what I say. Because if it's difficult to read, then you're asking people too much, right? Yeah. You want to make it conversational. It's even when I'm speaking, you're noticing I intentionally leave gaps. I pause. I make some sentences longer. I make some sentences longer. And that's a conscious thing I'm doing to make it more engaging. And you've got to do the same thing when you're writing. If you just do long sentence after long sentence, it's great for your dissertation because in a dissertation, you want to get a reading score of 18, so you seem smart, but you're not actually helping. So it's how do you make your message as coherent as possible and engaging as possible without losing what you're actually trying to say? And that's a skill, right? It's making it fun to read. It has to have a flow. I always say it should be like a roller coaster, right? Sometimes it's building up something and then you might have a few short sentences in a row because then that builds a hype. And then you might have a longer sentence, which is then building up towards another drop. And think of it in that way. Think for like music is that kind of idea. Whereas I think a lot of time people think about how can I get the information across rather than how can I get the emotion and the feeling? What do I want to evoke in the reader?
100%. I think it's that it's two things. It's how do I get information across and how do I sound smart? And ultimately, you know, people don't engage with smart. They engage with smart, coherent, and understandable, right? Because you could write a paper or white paper about, you know, let's say large language models, and 95% of the population aren't going to read that. But if you write, you know, a decent sort of couple of pages about why large language models are important in an understandable way, you're probably going to get, you know, a lot more understanding and probably questions that come out of that, right? And that's where you can then dive deeper, I guess.
I guess one more point on that, just to give people another dose, is you want to rotate between first person and third and second person, right? Mm. Because what some people do is say, you should do this, you should do that. And my straightaway reaction says, like, why are you telling me what
to
do?
Why are you telling me,
yeah. Whereas if you say, I did this, this and this, this really helped me, this could work for you too.
Yeah.
Then you're bringing them in, right? They're now relating to you and then doing your advice. Whereas if you're only writing the first person, then it's like, well, what am I getting out of this? But you want to be able to rotate between that and flip between that. Because then it varies it as well, right? Sometimes you're listening to them talk, sometimes they're talking to you, and it wants to be in that thing.
It's basically holding a conversation, much as we have done today. Amadeep, it has been really, really great to have you on the podcast with me today. Thank you so much. For our listeners, where can they find you? Are you online? Are you on LinkedIn, Twitter? Where's the best place for them to look for you?
Oh, so I think for me, the best thing is to just, if you go to my website, I think that's going to have all the links there. So that's amadeep.co. Because annoyingly, somebody is squatting on the amadeep.com website and hasn't used it in 20 years. And I've tried to pay them. I've tried to find them. They're
some
not taking my money.
In Punjab.
Yeah. And it's like, I'm giving you money. Just take it. And then for the Bay HQ side, it's just thebayhq.com. And it's the Bay HQ across socials as well.
Yeah. So that's BAEHQ.com for those of you who have not come across the British Asian Entrepreneurs Headquarters. Amadeep, thank you so much for joining me on the podcast today. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks so much for having me.